Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm your host, registered dietitian, and former professional runner, Maddie Alm. Today's guest is Boulder-based restaurateur, master sommelier, winemaker, and cookbook author, Bobby Stuckey. Bobby was an Arizona native and an NAU graduate. He worked his way up from being a busboy to working with Thomas Keller at the French Laundry, where he met his business partner, Lachlan McKinnon Patterson. Together in 2004, they opened Frasca Food and Wine in Boulder, Colorado, and went on to found the Frasca Hospitality Group that now includes five sister restaurants. In 2004, Bobby received his Master Sommelier diploma, making him just one of 279 people in the world to have this title. In 2020, Bobby became a founding member of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, which saved thousands of restaurants during the pandemic. Bobby is the recipient of three James Beard Awards, including the 2013 Award for Outstanding Wine Service, the 2019 Award for Outstanding Service, which actually was changed to Outstanding Hospitality in 2020 per Bobby's recommendation, and the 2025 Award for Outstanding Restaurant. Bobby currently lives in Boulder. He's also a 2:45 marathoner and tries to run a marathon every year with his brother. I hope you enjoy hearing from Bobby. All right, Bobby, welcome to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm so excited to have you here. We've overlapped in the running community and the food scene in Boulder, and you have such a unique perspective on food in that you've used it to fuel you with running, but it's also your passion and your career. So I'm excited to have you here today.
Well, Maddie, thank you for having me.
Yes, I'm excited to be here. And I want to just have a start by having you tell us a little bit about who you are.
Well, my name is Bobby Stuckey. I am a running fan and participant. I was a very high energy little kid. My parents had me run my first 10K, I think in 1977.
Wow.
And everyone else was playing Little League and my parents were taking me to 10Ks. I was never that great at it, but I was such an enthusiast, and my whole family, my mom, my brother, my dad, and I have been sharing that pastime since. My brother and I try to run a marathon once a year together.
Wow.
I started in the hospitalities industry in 1983 as a punk rock dyslexic, undiagnosed dyslexic kid who got kicked out of Jesuit school in Phoenix, Arizona.
Wow.
And my father and mother said, "You've just been promoted to be a public school kid." And they got me a job bussing tables. And the ironic thing is I'm still bussing tables. I'm bussing tables tonight. I was last night. But I am through that path of hospitality. I ended up being the 61st Master Sommelier in North America. So that's a diploma and a accreditation in the wine world. It's they say the hardest test. It's one of the exams in the wine world, Master Sommelier diploma. And I have spent my career in hospitality. So all my adult life and a better part of my adolescent life. I opened with my business partner, Lachlan McKinnon Patterson, and then Peter Hoagland, my wife, Danette Stuckey. We opened Frasca Food and Wine in 21 years ago. And that has become the mothership of our small hospitality group called the Frasca Hospitality Group.
Amazing. Wow. So you started off with your running career, it sounds like, when you were in high school. Is that right?
Before that.
Before high school.
In the 70s, I was like 8 years old. And everyone
wow.
else was playing Little League. But I started off bussing tables in high school, yes. But by the time I got to high school, I had already run so many 10Ks and half marathons and 15Ks. It was just something that running really found me.
Yeah. And what inspired you to become more competitive in running and to pursue racing?
You know, I fit the perfect mold in the mid 80s as a cross country runner, meaning I was a nerd. I was punk rock. I did not fit into the perfect world. And it's funny, my high school coach, Coach Renowicki, his son is actually Under Armour professional runner.
Is that John?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
He ran for Arizona State.
Amazing.
He looks exactly like my high school. He looked exactly like his dad did when his dad was that age.
Wow. That must be weird for you to watch.
Well, the first time I met him, I like came around the corner at Pizzeria Alberico. I was like, oh my God, this has to be my coach's son.
Wow. Okay, so you're still really connected in the running world for many reasons. Your former high school coach, his son is now a professional runner. What was running for you like in high school? Was it something that you took seriously, or was it something that you were just doing to be a part of a sport?
Well, I had aspirations. I wanted to run collegiately. I tried my hardest. The only problem for me was I think I would have been more cut out for maybe a Division II or Division III program. I ended up going to Northern Arizona University. They were a dynasty then, like they are now, and I just couldn't make the team. But I had also found triathlons and cycling, so I had a different outlet to use. And I ended up finding out that I was even though I like running more, I was more talented at cycling, and ended up racing in Spain in 1992, and then came back and was for a small amount of time a domestic pro here in the United States. But I always stayed with running. Every off season, I would be right back to running just because it really filled me. And I feel that Bobby, as the restaurant person, is Bobby because of running. I have been a big advocate in our industry, the hospitality industry, of that having other releases other than food and wine and beverages. Our industry is not known for that, and historically has not been known for that. And I really truly believe that it makes great restaurant hospitality people if you find an outlet outside of to balance things off. I was so proud 2 weeks ago. We had 10 employees do the Boulder-thon, either 5K, 10K, or half marathon. One person ran their first marathon. I had employees who'd never done a running race before. It was really great.
That's so awesome. And I really love that advice. That's something, it's funny because a lot of people I talk to on this podcast are professional runners. So we talk about, finding that balance with life outside of running. And for you, your life outside of your career is running. So that's such a unique perspective and a good reminder to runners that, yes, running is one part of your life, but it's a great way to offer balance in general.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that. So going back a little bit, you mentioned getting kicked out of Jesuit school. I want to hear a little bit more about that.
Well, I'm in my mid-50s, so we didn't really, the world's changed a lot, and I didn't get diagnosed that I was dyslexic and had some other learning disabilities until I was like in college. So I was this, what you used to call a hyper kid, non-focused, and definitely struggled. And it wasn't that I was a bad kid. I just didn't fit into that mold of education at that time period. And look, I was, the Jesuits were like, they normally do pretty well with kids. Like I was maybe just a little bit on the bell curve on the wrong direction for them.
Wow. That's incredible. And I think that's, a good reminder too that dyslexia, it really can impact different areas of your life. And for you, it was just at a time when that wasn't really a recognized diagnosis, and getting more resources, finding something that was a better fit for you, it sounds like still allows you to succeed and find what you want to do in life and go on to go to college and all of those things. And I like that there is just different approaches to the world and different ways that we see and learn. And I think it's important to have those perspectives.
Yeah, and I think like anything in Mother Nature, if you just keep plugging along, Mother Nature will give you other strengths. That's just a fact of life. If you're positive and you wake up and you just put one foot in front of the other, Mother Nature will give you different strengths. And you just need to be doing positive forward growth, and those strengths will come up.
Absolutely. And yours did. Your strength came up. You ended up becoming a busboy. My first job was also in a restaurant. I was a hostess. How did you end up choosing that as your job? You said your dad told you you needed to get a job. How did that become the one you chose?
I think my dad was like, okay, look, you're not like academics is like you going to a great college. That train left the station. So let's just set some doable goals. And I think this is like, if you think about in the early 80s, him doing this, this was very Zen-like parenting. He and my mom, they were just filled with positivity. They're like, here's three things you got to do. You got to have a job. You have to have a GPA to get into a college. We're like, we're not looking at Ivy League for you. And back then, there was a big catalog book. And my mom is like, see, like some of these colleges, you only need a 2.5 GPA. And so I had to have a job, a GPA to get into a college or a university. And I had to have an extracurricular activity. So cross country, no one gets cut from cross country.
Yep.
So that box was taken care of. I got a job bussing tables. As long as the restaurant industry is a beautiful industry, it's a big tent. Everyone's allowed in as long as you work hard and put one step in front of the other. So it was an industry that was perfect for me. And so that's how I started bussing tables. And it really, I feel so lucky. I feel so lucky I got kicked out of Jesuit school to be able to do that.
I love the way you describe that as it's a tent that everyone's welcome into. I would argue running is similar. Anyone can join in. If you can get a pair of running shoes, you can be a runner. And I think that's so special about both the restaurant industry and the running world.
Well, yeah, and if you look at the 1960 Rome Olympics, Bekele, he didn't even have shoes and he won the marathon.
There you go. I guess you don't even need shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's very inclusive and it's a great way just to I think give yourself an opportunity to grow in a more non-traditional way and you get out of it what you put into it, of course, with the sport of running, but I'm assuming as well with the restaurant industry. So how did you go from, working as a busser, working your way up to now being a powerhouse in the hospitality industry?
Well, I didn't start as a busser saying I'm going to be a master sommelier. I didn't even know what it was. But what happened was, and I think all of us can use this in any walk of life of what you're doing, is I didn't try to trampoline up to the top. It was all about fundamentals. And I mention this often is that we always talk about craft coffee. We talk about craft cocktails, artisan beer, artisan wine. But sometimes in the United States currently, we don't like to craft ourselves. And there are no prodigies in the restaurant business. You can only be a prodigy in technically mathematics, chess, music, and art. So those are industries that you can work really hard in also, but they are ones that some people can't be a prodigy at. Like there's a guy who's 7 years old and beat the grandmaster chess. That
Wow.
young person is obviously a prodigy. In restaurants, you need to plug away at all the positions. And during my era, it was more normal to do that. Now the world's kind of changed. Everyone wants things immediate. But I started as a bus person. And then there was a day that someone called in sick, and I got to get trained as an expediter. And then I got trained as, waiter assistant. Then I was a front waiter. I got thrown into being a front waiter and I did that for a long time. And then I would go to wine class as a waiter and I really liked wine. I thought that was like, wow. But I didn't know I was in college in the late 80s, early 90s. We didn't have things like we do now. Like we have TV shows like The Bear and TV Food Network. Like there's all these things that let people signal about the industry. We didn't have that then. And I remember seeing an envelope on my boss's desk it was maybe 1992 or 93 in Flagstaff, Arizona, where I was living. And it was for the quartermaster sommeliers. And I asked him, I go, what is this? He goes, oh, it's for wine professionals. It's this thing. And it was the first time I had seen something that was like a professional path. So I said, can I open the envelope? And he said, yeah, well, you can have it. And so then I hand wrote a snail mail letter to the group asking about everything. And then they gave me the schedule for the next year. And I think it took me about a year and a half, maybe till 1994. I went and took my first intro level, the beginning baby test. And I was like, wow, this is great. It's funny, one of the guys who taught my class was a guy that we lost about 20 years ago to a heart attack. His name was Michael Bonacorsi, and he was like an incredible master sommelier and an incredible educator. the full circle moment is his nephew works for me now. Yeah, that just, it just sent me in the right path. And I just kept plugging away at it. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And then each job I got, I made sure to work as hard as I could at that job. And then maybe that position morphed into something else. And it's been a long road.
Yeah, incredible though. And I'm curious, getting into, you know, the food industry, hospitality industry, what was your relationship with food like growing up? What was food like in your household? Was it something that you were passionate about, or did you kind of find that passion along this career path?
It was very much part of our household. My mom had a catering company. She was a chef. She
Wow.
was, and then before that, she was just, you know, she went to culinary school. She was, I mean, like, early on, like it's kind of a surreal moment, but my mom was like cooking out of like Julia Child's book when I was a kid. She had every issue of like gourmet, and I just ate differently than other kids. My mom, that was a big thing. And she's still 79 years old. She's still like that. And so it was always around us. I'm like one of the first people that had parents that like liked wine. So like, you know, that generation, they were more martini and whatever. And my mom liked wine. So there was just things that support, and also my parents just supporting me as a bus person. Like they're like, oh, you like this? Let's go forward at this. Most parents, that's not the case. They looked at the rest. Most parents looked at the restaurant industry at that time period as a solidly blue collar job and didn't want their kids to aspire to that. My parents thought it was great. And that's a real big positive.
Yeah, absolutely. And something I talk about a lot of people on the podcast with is how important that relationship with food is at home, how parents foster that from such a young age. And it sounds like for you, your parents really instilled a sense of curiosity and just being able to try new foods out of the box, I think is so important for developing your palate and having that healthy relationship with food as you get older.
Yeah, my mom like making homemade granola for us. Like it was just like a, it was a wacky world in the Stuckey household.
I'm sure that's something that has just really carried with you throughout your career in the food industry. And something we've talked about already a little bit is how many parallels there are between the running world and hospitality world. So for you being a runner, what are some of the traits that you find you're using every day in your career?
So many. Running makes Bobby the master sommelier. I mean, Anthony Bourdain, rest in peace, was an incredible storyteller, but he didn't tell the whole story. He told the story that was really electric for him, of the chaos, the hard charging restaurant people. And I met him in 2000 or 2001 when I worked at the French Laundry, and he was doing that original show. And I remember talking to him, and he's like, well, what's it like here working at the French Laundry? And I was like, oh, it's the easiest job ever. And he was like, wait, what? He was like upset because that didn't fit into the narrative. He's like, that can't be. You work for Thomas Keller. I'm like, no, it's so easy. Thomas tells us what we need to do. You do it. The whole team understands it. Like Thomas could be an incredible coach, CEO, in our case, a chef. But running plays into that. If you have a plan and you show up every day and do a little bit of it, anything's possible. You can change yourself via running by doing it. You can also change yourself in the hospitality industry by showing up, taking care of yourself. I have this weird analogy called the 90% rule. So we've already talked about me not being good at academics. But at least I paid attention, and I know that 90% to 100 is considered excellent. Now, I didn't click that box much with my report cards, but I knew that. So you've got a work week. You got a 5-day work week. You also have maybe a 5 to a 6-day running week. So in my industry, people historically have gone out after work and they've drank and done that. I haven't gone out after work since 1999.
Wow.
And it's not that I'm a prude. I love having a glass of wine, like the best of them. But I want to protect my 90%. I want, if you've got a 5 or a 6-day work week, if you show up banged up or not focused for one of them, the best you can be that week is 80%. if you're a runner or an athlete, especially if you're an elite athlete, or not even elite, if you're just me, 56-year-old Bobby, getting ready for a marathon, I have to think about each work week and if I can squeeze in my runs. And if I'm going to go to the Oval Office on Wednesday mornings, I have to pay attention to my schedule and get there. It's the same thing. You want to be trying to be at 90% because life is going to throw you curveballs. Yeah, because something happens. You get a cold, you're not feeling well, or you're going to work and your boyfriend calls and tells you something wacky or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you try every week to be 90% or above, then those weeks that get sideways won't matter as much. Kind of like marathon training. If you do a long buildup and you treat every week okay, you don't get greedy. Sure, if you get a cold or you get a little injury, you're still going to be have a lot of fitness. You're going to be okay.
Yeah. I love that advice. Protect your 90%. I think that's so important from a career standpoint, from a running standpoint. And that's such a good way to look at that. If you miss one day because you didn't protect that 90%, now you're down to 80, and that can catch up with you pretty quickly over time for sure. So I love that connection. And, I'm always saying to people how much running build skills for life and for your future career. And it's something that's just, I think, gives back so much more than it takes, which is such a special thing about the sport.
It's the best.
Yeah.
And everyone can do it and it'll make their work better.
Yes, absolutely. I really think it does. And it shows you what you're capable of. You can do hard things. You can challenge yourself. You can push yourself. And I don't think people who aren't involved in a sport like running really get to exercise that part of their brain very often. I think it's something we lose as we get older and stop challenging ourselves in that way.
Yeah, I remember the day that I finally passed the Master Sommelier diploma. I'd had a lot of struggles. And I remember I was in San Francisco and I went out for a run. I went down towards the marina and I said, this is kind of weird, but I'm going to just do a fartlek workout.
Yeah.
Because if you go do something hard, it's hard to think about other things.
Also true.
I was doing a fartlek and I finished up. I was kind of going back to my hotel. I had to shower, put a suit on for the exam. And I bump into someone like on the corner going to my hotel, kind of a mentor to me. And he's like, oh my God, I did not want to see you before the exam. I don't want to get you nervous. I said, I'm not nervous. I haven't even thought about the exam. I did such a hard workout. I couldn't even think about it. And he was like, oh my, this kid is so nuts. And then I went, showered, showed up, passed the MS exam.
Wow.
Getting a
Amazing.
Run in beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great way to clear your mind and get your priorities straight for sure. And I think that's like, it's the brain blood flow moving into your brain and all those things. I used to do that before finals and all of that. It was so helpful. And speaking of your Master Sommelier title, I want to hear a little bit about how you become a Master Sommelier. What does that look like? What is the training like? And what is the testing like?
Well, there's currently 4 levels. So you have your intro, which is like just getting your ankles wet. It's a couple day course. Then you take an exam, and then you have your certified, which at the certified, you've got to blind taste a couple wines, do a service, do a theory. It's 6 wines that you have to taste in 25 minutes.
Wow.
So you have 6 wines, could be 3 whites, 3 reds. Don't know anything about it. As soon as you touch it, the clock starts and you have to like kind of go through whatever process you use to find out what those wines are.
Wow. Amazing. What was the hardest part for you?
Test anxiety, just
Yeah.
getting nervous.
Yeah.
You only have one day a year to do it. But, if you look at it on paper, I struggled the tasting exam because I got so nervous. But once I figured it out, it was pretty straightforward like the other 3.
Incredible.
Easier to calm down for theory because there's not a clock really. You can just kind of click through the questions.
Yeah.
So you can kind of, for me, I was able to moderate myself better for that.
So your main focus, I know for a while, was kind of on the wine side, developing wine menus. And then you opened Frasca, Food and Wine. And now obviously food is a big part of that. So what does it look like opening a high-end restaurant like that? What goes into developing the menu and the wine pairing?
Yeah, so Lachlan, whom I met at the French Laundry, he was our opening chef. He's still my business partner. Lachlan was our opening chef. Now we have Ian Palazzolo, and we have a culinary director for the whole company, Eduardo Vallelobo. And now we're somewhat of we have six restaurants. We have about 250 employees. My day now will be maybe interfacing with the chefs of hearing what they want to do, inspiration, and seeing where it goes in our POV, point of view. So our point of view at Frasca is the region of Friuli Venezia Giulia. So the idea is that's our North Star. Versus, so if the trend right now is crazy Korean food, that's great. We'll do that on our night off. But at Frasca, we're at this POV. Each restaurant will, like Pizzeria Alberico is about Napolitana style pizza. That's that POV. And then how do things work within that? And we work a lot with our local farmers. We're very lucky here in Boulder that not only are they great farmers, they're really curious. So we have farmers that actually that have taken seeds that we've gotten them of ingredients that we use in Friuli Venezia Giulia to be
Wow.
grown in Boulder for us.
Wow.
So like there's this whole process of, hey, we can't be in Friuli, but maybe we can grow this spring herb sclopete. Or maybe we can get the radicchio roses de Gorizia grown for us here. And those are the things we've done. Or different squashes because we're going into the fall, things like that.
Wow, amazing. So what's your favorite part of developing a menu?
My favorite part is letting the chefs do their thing. And currently, because Lachlan runs our wine program, our chefs might come to me, maybe not for menu ideas, but inspirations about Friuli. So, like, I've written a book with Lachlan on the region of Friuli Venezia Giulia called Friuli Food and Wine. They might be like, hey, Bobby, we're working on this polenta dish. What do you think historically would go on here? That would be a great example. Like, or because not all of them get to go over to Friuli as much as I do. I'm over there because we have a winery over there. We're over there a lot. Maybe not for a long time, but you might be there spring, winter, fall, summer, and you're seeing these ideas. And you can go to a chef that maybe has only been there once and said, hey, you were there in spring. This is what happens culturally in the fall. We've got to tap into that.
So it sounds like there's a lot of considerations for seasons, for culture, how flavors pair together. And again, I think you just have such a unique perspective on what food is. A lot of people who listen to this maybe struggle with their relationship with food or disordered eating. And sometimes I think it can be helpful to get a fresh perspective like this on food being something that's so incredible, adding to culture and things like that. So is there anything you could say to somebody who might be listening who's feeling stuck in their relationship with food?
Yeah, I look at, I'm going to use the region of Friuli Venezia Giulia. So, for those of you who've looked at a map of Italy, it's as far north as you go and as far east as you go. So, it is the northern part of what was the Roman Empire. It's the southern part of what was the Austrian Empire till 1917.
Wow.
It was the western border of what we in the United States call Eastern Europe, but really in Friuli, you call it Middle Europe. So that's for this sake, Middle Europe. And those cultures have been together, living together on and off for hundreds of years. And because of Trieste being the only port city of the Austrian Empire, it's the port city of Friuli. Everything that you think of, spices on the Danube River up in Austria and Hungary, coffee, all those things came through Trieste. So I love, for me to fall in love with food, with the cultural aspect. And the cultural aspect of Friuli Venezia Giulia is so robust. It's not like the rest of Italy. It's so we might have a stuffed pasta, but we might not call it a ravioli. We might call it a calzone or a zlikrofi, which means spoon dumpling in Slovenian. And it's all these things together. And I think for me, when I get to sit down at the end of the night at Frasca, and Chef Ian Palazzolo is like, "Hey, you want to try this new representation of the Zlikrofi?" I'm thinking about the dish that he made. I'm thinking about what went on for hundreds of years that made that dish important to people.
I love that. Yeah, it's more than just the food. It's thinking about how the food got there, the culture behind it, even the farms that grew it, the culture that brought it to you. I think that just really helps to kind of get out of your head a little bit around food and think about it in those terms instead of kind of the black and white, good or bad, or healthy or unhealthy. There's so much more to food than those terms.
Yeah, and I think that I feel bad that people have a tough relationship with food. I feel bad because remember, there's so much part of the ecosystem of humanity that is based on, it's the cornerstone, food is the cornerstone species of humanity. Doesn't matter if you're eating injera from Ethiopia or if you're having barbecue ribs in Memphis. Or you're eating a Olathe corn in the western slope of Colorado. There is so much about that. It's so important. And maybe if we look at it culturally, it will help us ease our anxiety with food.
Yeah, I love that. That's such good advice. And again, being a runner yourself, food plays a really big role in performance and in training. So I'm curious, how have you found food to help you when it comes to your training or your performance on race day?
Well, for me, a couple of things. Race day, I'm really pretty straightforward. I pretty much treat every Saturday long run like my race day food prep with just less sleep because I work Friday nights. So, like, make sure I have a little coffee. I've got my granola and yogurt program. That really works. Maybe a banana, maybe some almond butter. That's it. But what I think about my race day is the couple of days before. Look, I'm in my mid-50s. I've made enough mistakes that I have to pay attention to what's going on the couple of days before that big effort. Even if it's not a race, even if it's like I'm running up at Mag's with my friends on Saturday, I gotta treat Friday and Thursday a little differently going up to Mag's. You know, if you're in your mid-50s, you're running Mag's. After being on the floor Friday night till a certain time, you got to be careful
Yeah.
because you can really have a bad day up there, you know?
Absolutely.
And for those of you listening, Mag's is a road in Boulder, Colorado that's either famous or infamous, depending on what day you there.
It's a really good way to describe it. It's a brutal mountain road that just goes up, 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 and up. And you start at what, like 7,000 feet? You get up to over 9,000 feet, depending on what section of the road you're running and which direction. And it was definitely my nemesis in college at CU. I remember struggling quite a bit. And ironically, I would work at Chautauqua Dining Hall in the restaurant industry. And I would always try not to get the Friday or Saturday shift before the long run day. Sometimes it inevitably happened. And it does, it really saps your legs when you're standing all day in a restaurant. So I'm really impressed that you are able to do that Friday and then go long run on Saturday. And I know a lot of people listening can probably relate to that kind of job related exhaustion and then training on top of that. And it sounds like for you, the fueling piece has helped you navigate that a little bit.
100% because then I'm going to come back Saturday and get it 8,000 steps in that night at work at Frasca. Mags is so infamous or famous in my restaurant group, even for the non-runners. They know, I mean, this happened and I didn't get mad at the employee, but I had a really tough day at Mags earlier this year. It just fell apart. I was exhausted. And we had a big, big Saturday night. And by the second turn, I'm like, whoa. And one of my employees puts their hand on my shoulder and they're like, you know, maybe Mags is a little aggressive for you today for
Oh
this many covers. I was like, you know, and this
How
employee
dare
is like
you?
20, 28 years old. I was about to kill him. I was like, what? But I love the fact that I have staff members that know the importance of mags for
That's
me.
so amazing. That's such a bolder thing.
Yes, totally.
Wow. Okay. So the outside of running, fueling important for sure. I'm curious, how about your experience with fueling during marathons? You said you try to run a marathon every year. So I would imagine you've had some good, some bad. What are some things that you've learned about fueling during the marathon itself?
Well, I've been doing endurance sports forever, right?
Right.
So like I raced bicycles in the early 90s. What we had access to then was like a flat Coca-Cola
Yeah.
and like a power bar, which was horrible. I think there's so much access to things. One thing I have not experimented with, I've read a lot about it, and you're hearing a lot about people doing a lot more carb intake for the run. That the guy who destroyed everyone at Leadville this year, he lives here locally, David. He like talks about how much fuel he takes. I have not had success with that yet with my stomach, but for me, I'm 180 pounds, so I'm not like a flyweight runner. I'm 5'10". When I do a marathon, I kind of have this approach. I go to the marathon. I have a little packet that I go to the start area with some scratch lab to hydrate beforehand. I keep it with me all the way until the beginning of the run. And then I will have at around 15K, take a gel, half take a gel, 30K take a gel. So about three gels for me in a marathon, but I always have a fourth if I feel like it might help me in that last 10K. Now, I've heard a lot of people doing a lot more fueling than that. I just don't know if my GI system handles that much gels.
Yeah, that's fair.
But,
Gels can be tough to get down. I fully understand that for sure.
and like I saw a couple of guys that ran New York with me last year with my brother. A couple of them tried that bicarbonate stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That's not for me.
Brutal. Yeah,
No, thank
absolutely
you.
brutal.
Look, at my age, I don't need a lactic acid buffer that much.
Honestly, you really don't for long distance anyway. It's just not really that helpful. So it's not worth it. Yeah. Okay. So marathon training has been really a big thing for you in the background throughout your career in the hospitality industry. And something you've been passionate about is describing your career in the hospitality industry rather than the food service industry. And I'm curious about why specifically you use that verbiage.
Because my craft and our craft that we're in my industry is not just service. Service is what you do to someone. Hospitality is how you make someone feel. And we're in the hospitality industry, not just to our customers, but our coworkers, our employees. How do we make them feel is so important in life. And I wish there was more hospitality in so many different industries. In DC, maybe right now, with both parties, there's so many opportunities for hospitality. So I really try to live every day in that space of being able to realize that it's not about me, it's about someone else at all times.
Yeah, I love that way of thinking, and I know as a society we could do better with that. And speaking of the kind of political side of things, you co-founded the Independent Restaurant Coalition during COVID, which was actually a huge reason why a lot of restaurants were able to stay afloat throughout COVID. Tell us a little bit about what that is.
Well, I'm sitting at my kitchen table that got a lot of use during the IRC, the Independent Restaurant Coalition time period. So what happened is pretty much Monday, March 16th, 2020, all restaurants in the US pretty much got closed. And so two things happened. Most American restaurateurs had been paying into an insurance, business interruption insurance. So for that time, we were 16 years in at Frasca. We had spent 16 years of premiums, never had a claim. We thought we were going to be okay. No one knew this, that every restaurant in America had a clause in their policy that protected insurance companies. So no one got anything, but we were closed. And then we didn't know what to do. We didn't have an advocate for our industry. We're the biggest employer, private sector in America. We're 12 million jobs. To put that in perspective, the airline industry is about as many jobs as the city of New York has restaurant employees. Wow. So we dwarf everyone else, but no one really understood us and we didn't understand ourselves. So on March 16th, we got closed. March 18th, the IRC, Independent Restaurant Coalition, was founded. We didn't know it was the IRC that day. We came up with that name. And we didn't know what we were doing. We were really, you know, have you ever heard the term building the plane while it was flying?
Yeah.
That was the IRC. We had one person in our group, Tom Colicchio, Chef Tom Colicchio from TV, Top Chef.
Yeah.
He had advocated in DC. So he was able to tell us, dude, we don't know what we're doing. And he's really bright. And he kind of helped us. And then all of us together, just every morning, they were on the East Coast. Some of us were on the West Coast. I was in Colorado. We would get up. We started at 7:30 in the morning. We would lock in. Then they moved it to 8:30, I think, like, because we had a lot of work to do on the East Coast. So we couldn't be that late, right? Because we had to get things going. And for the next year and a half, we did things like we helped the congressman in Portland, Oregon, Earl Blumenauer. He wrote a white paper. So if you remember School of Rock as a kid, you write a paper, white paper, then it becomes a bill. The bill goes to the Hill and he hopes to become law.
Yeah.
We lived School of Rock. Earl Blumenauer wrote a bill. Bill went to the Hill. Nancy Pelosi put it in the Heroes Act. Mitch McConnell killed it at the 11th hour and 45 minute. We were despondent, just like on the little cartoon. The bill got really sad. Then there was a change in the Senate with the runoff in Georgia. We represent, we just tirelessly used our running technique of one step in front of the other, represented the bill. It got put in the American Rescue Plan and it saved 165,000 restaurants.
Wow.
And I really think going back to running, it helped me every day get up. I have a loop. I ran it today, actually. I never ran this loop until COVID. But I would run parts of it. But I had to wake up early and I had to be like how we are now.
Yeah.
Every morning by 7:30. So
wow.
I would wake up and do this loop. I called it the IRC loop. It was like 8.6 miles from my house. And I would do it and I would have a towel. I would towel off, put it my shirt on and like lock in to talking to a congressman. And they're like, God, this guy looks really fresh for being in COVID.
That's amazing. Wow. So running was steadfast for you throughout COVID while you were saving 165,000 restaurants, which is really incredible. You've done so many amazing things in the hospitality industry. Most recently, you did win another. I know you've won two now, James Beard Awards. This one was for Outstanding Restaurant. What does that award mean to you? What goals do you have kind of moving forward for your restaurant in the future?
Well, first of all, I didn't win the award. My team did.
Your team won.
I happen to be the one who was in front of the microphone.
Okay.
But there is a lot of team members that make that happen.
Yeah.
What it means to us is we have a idea that we have our North Star of Friuli Venezia Giulia, and we're going to try to get better a little bit every day. So that award was amazing. But I flew back straight from that award and went right to work that next night with the whole team pre-service because our goal is to get a little bit better every day. So we love when those things happen. We love it, but our craft is to do a little bit more each day, a little bit better each day. So we're so lucky to be a 21-year-old restaurant and to have gotten a little bit better that if we keep doing this, it's going to be really exciting. So Sergey, our GM, Chef Ian, now I feel bad. Ian Palazzolo is the only, our chef was not at the award ceremony. He's the only guy who had something more important that day. They had a baby that week.
Oh, okay. I guess that's an acceptable reason
so
to
he
visit.
and his wife, Clara, who's a sommelier at Tavernetta in Denver.
Wow.
Keep it all in the family. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I hope Claire's not listening to this, but we actually had at the ready, if Ian wanted to fly out to the awards ceremony, we would get him a plane ticket. I'm like, do not tell anyone we have this plan. Now, he didn't do it. He was smarter than that. But I know I would be the one who would have gotten in trouble for that.
That's amazing. And I love that perspective of like celebrate the win, but keep moving forward. And I think that's also something we see in running. You know, the race day, celebrating a win on race day or a PR or whatever it may be is so important because it's such a long grind to get there. But then usually it's back to work and keep going and see what you can do if you get another training block under your belt. And I love just the overlap for you between running and your career in hospitality, and you're so incredible at both. And it's been so fun talking with you. And kind of wrapping up, what are some pieces of advice you could give to anyone listening who might want to get into food or hospitality a little bit more?
Well, the food industry and the hospitality industry is the door's open to you. If you're new to this country and you don't speak the language, we're here for you. If God forbid you made a mistake and maybe we even went to jail, we will give you a job. If you were in a different industry that AI took your job, come on over. We're ready for you. Or you just need to shake up your life and you need something different. Come on over. The great thing about the hospitality industry and the food industry, we're always going to be there. We're always going to need food. We're always going to need farmers. We're always going to need restaurants. We're going to need grocery stores. So there's so many different things you can do. Just knock on the doors. We'll let you in.
I love that. That's really great advice. And how about any advice for someone who's wanting to get into cooking, maybe for the first time, or explore a little bit more new recipes, new flavors?
I think let's take a page out of Julia Child. She taught America how to cook by not being afraid of flipping an omelet. Like, who cares? It's gonna be, no one's gonna like, everything's gonna be okay. We're not saving lives. Try it. Try to do something at home. Try to do something. If you're intimidated with the kitchen, it's okay. It's just a knob. Heat it up if you burn it. It's not going to kill anybody. It's okay. If it doesn't look good on Instagram, it doesn't matter. Some of the best dishes in the world don't look good on Instagram. So, there's so much. It's just, look, we were talking about it earlier. Food and cooking and everything about what we do is about, it's so important to us. Fall in love with it. It's going to be great.
I love
Now, I don't
that.
know how I married Danette, my wife, because she's the only beautiful Italian woman in the world that does not like cooking at home. Like her grandmother used to say that to me. She's like, I got to tell you, I love my granddaughter, but I don't even know if she's really Italian. She doesn't like cooking.
Wow, so are you the cook at home?
Well, we only have Sunday nights off, but we'll fake through it, whatever. But it's like she doesn't have that Italian vibe
Instinct.
on that. It's so funny. It's awesome.
That's amazing. Anyone can
Oh, it's
try it.
so
I
funny. I
love
was like, how did I marry
that.
the only beautiful Italian woman that I don't even think she doesn't even like, yeah, it's not her thing.
That's
It's
so
awesome.
funny. I'm sure she brings other things to the table, pun intended.
Always, always.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Bobby, for sharing all of that with us. It's been so fun to hear from you. I'd love to wrap up with our fun rapid fire questions. All right, you sort of already answered this one, but what is your go-to pre-run snack?
Well, in the morning, little coffee, little yogurt, little granola.
Perfect. This is going to be an interesting question for you. What would you pick for your last meal?
Depends on what time of year.
Oh, okay.
Okay, if it's later than mid-October and before January 1, it would have to be great, great handmade pasta with tartufi bianchi, white truffles. Got
Wow.
it. But
Yep.
Mother Nature, she's kind of a rude lady. Like she only gives us like 6 weeks of that. So I've got a lot of questions for her. But that's if it's that time of year. If it's like in the summertime, my last meal would be sitting at the sea and grotto in Friuli. with Danette, my wife. And if she was sending me off saying that's your last meal, like just great pesce crudo, raw fish from the Adriatic, and then a bronzino done in sale in salt crusted, and a great bottle of Malvasia, like aromatic white wine from Friuli.
Wow,
Take
amazing.
it.
That's the highest level answer we've had on here so far. Sounds
Okay.
amazing. I love it. What is your favorite dessert?
I am genetically have a disposition to ice cream. If you
Me too.
follow our restaurant, he's leaving today to drive back down to Phoenix. But my father has been into ice cream since I was a little kid. People who grew up with us always tell the story of my dad taking all the kids out for ice cream. He still does it. He will randomly show up at Frasca, like, and Pizzeria Alberico, just randomly on any given Saturday, not tell anyone, show up at pre-service. That's when we have our meeting with like 100 Klondike bars for the whole building.
That's
And people are
amazing.
like, what is the deal with the Stuckey's and the client? And like I wasn't even in town last week. I was at a James Beard dinner in New York, and I get a text from Eduardo, our culinary director, with his arm around my dad and my dad with this huge bag of Klondike bars. I wasn't even
Wow.
in the building, and he's
That's
passing.
incredible.
So I love ice cream.
I love that. Ice cream. That's mine too. That's a classic. This is interesting too. What is your least favorite food, or do you even have a least favorite food?
I love all food. I don't, this is weird. I like the flavor of it, but I'm not supposed to eat it. I have a weird allergy to shiitake mushrooms.
Interesting.
And I have a
Okay.
friend who's a chef in Philadelphia, and his wife, Megan, has the exact same allergy.
Wow. That's so interesting.
But I like them,
You just
but I
can't eat
can't
them.
have them. But I'm pretty much, besides that, I am like, I'll
All
try
food.
anything.
Awesome. That's a good trait to have. All right, I'm doing a little audible here for asking a different question. You worked at French Laundry, which is a very high-end restaurant, of course. Who was your favorite person or most famous person that you served?
There's a lot of the textbook famous people that you think of.
Sure.
All those were great. I think two different people, one at the Little Nell before the French Laundry and one at the French Laundry. At the French Laundry, I would have to say I always loved when Robert Mondavi would come in with his wife, Marguerite. They just were the epitome of Napa Valley. And I said, and there were so many famous people there, but those two, amazing. But the most famous person I ever, like, this is famous, cool to me, maybe not anyone else. Really beautiful. I got to take care of Stephen Hawkins.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes. And so if you anyone knows Stephen Hawkins, very bright gentleman. He was in a wheelchair, only could use talk through like a device and eat through a straw, and he drank 1991 Chave Hermitage, one of the classic Northern Rhone wines of
Wow.
the last 100 years, with his friend, who was also in a wheelchair,
Wow.
who had also had disabilities. The two of them, Les Pure was the gentleman's name, and they were amazing with their spouses. Amazing.
Incredible. Wow, what a story. That's amazing. What is your go-to lazy meal that you make at home if you're ever home to cook?
Go to lazy meal at home would be probably some tacos and a beer and a Modelo beer.
Awesome. Great
With,
combo.
I have a huge, yeah, that would be it right there. And a little avocado on the side. I'm like, I grew up in Phoenix, all about that.
Yeah, that's a great combo. Amazing. The last question I normally ask, favorite coffee or tea drink, but I kind of want to ask you your favorite wine, which might be a bad question because I'm sure there's a lot. But if you had to pick one, if you could pick one, what would be your favorite wine?
Depending on the time of the year.
Yeah.
But if it was that time when white truffles were going on, I would like to drink 1985 Quinterno Monfortino,
Wow.
guaranteed. It was before Roberto Quinterno was making the wine. He's the current winemaker. That's when his father made it. Desert Island wine for fall. If it was any other time of the year, couple things. I have a restaurant based on Friuli Venezia Giulia, maybe a great bottle of Friulano white. There's so many things I could get unwrap that I just think about all the time.
I'm sure. I love the concept of desert island wine, though. I'm all on board for
Yeah,
that. That's
totally.
super
We
fun.
all gotta have that action because it's gotta be aspirational.
Yeah.
So, because in case you get to have it, then you'll know. Damn
Right.
straight, I better have that ready.
Yeah, it's worth it for sure. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Bobby. I'm going to put a link in the show notes to your restaurant group so people can check out all the different restaurants you have to offer. You have some incredible ones in Boulder, in Denver, in the mountain areas. I know Vail is one as well. Anywhere else that people can find your restaurants?
That's right there. That's what we
Those are the
got.
ones. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, and best of luck with everything in the restaurant world and in the running world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. You can find some links in the show notes to the Frasca Hospitality Group to learn more about their restaurants. Next week's episode will be a Q&A with me, so if you'd like to submit a question to be answered on air, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.